Chapter 4. During the early part of the century, while infectious diseases were rapidly declining, a few microbe hunters began to sense the changing of the tide. Cancer was on the rise, if only because people now lived long enough to develop it, and its puzzling nature invited innumerable conflicting explanations. The early microbiologists began applying their tools to the chase of hypothetical cancer-causing germs. Among the first to make the connection was the German Emperor Kaiser Wilhelm II, who addressed Robert Koch in 1905 at a reception in honor of his Nobel Prize. Mein lieber Jahrhemat, nur mal ran an den Krebserreger. My dear professor, now you must get the cancer bug. Despite the imperial encouragement, the results of cancer microbiology remained wanting and did not impress Hans de Witt Stetten, the gray eminence of the National Institutes of Health, NIH. During the heyday of bacteriology, many attempts were made to find a microbial cause of cancer. Bacteria, fungi, and other microorganisms, often named after their discoverer, were isolated and proposed as candidates. But none of the claims withstood the rigorous criteria of bacterial causation enunciated by Koch. But virus hunting was gradually arriving. As more sophisticated technologies for working with viruses became available, the virologists wished to try their hand at explaining cancer. However, they faced two bothersome paradoxes in trying to blame viruses for cancer. First, cancer is not contagious, but all viral diseases are. So how could a virus cause cancer? And second, the typical virus reproduces by entering a living cell and commandeering the cell's resources in order to make new virus particles, a process that ends with the disintegration of the dead cell. Cancer, on the other hand, is a disease of cells that continue to live. Something goes wrong with perfectly normal cells, and they begin changing their behavior and appearance, refusing to cooperate with the rest of the body. Such abnormal cells eventually begin growing relentlessly, invading nearby tissues, and ultimately spreading throughout the host. The patient dies once these increasingly voracious parasites have caused enough disruption. So if viruses kill cells, how could they possibly cause some cells to grow too well? Amazingly, over the next several decades, cancer virology not only rescued itself from this initial quandary and the threat of obsolescence, but even managed to seize control of the entire cancer field. Their answer to the first question was that cancer may very well be infectious if one is only patient enough to wait for the virus to progress from infection to cancer, a period said to be over 50 years for viral leukemia and viral cervical cancer. A very delayed infectivity indeed. The answer to the second question was to postulate either defective killer viruses, unable to multiply but still able to cause cancer, or a unique class of non-cytotoxicidal, non-cell-killing viruses, the retroviruses acting as carcinogens. With these sophisticated concepts, tumor virologists reached the pinnacle of political success in the 1980s and were well-positioned to dominate AIDS research from the start. This is the story of their rise to power despite having no proof for their germ cancer hypothesis. As with any example of science gone awry, cancer virology began with perfectly legitimate observations of rare phenomena. Searching relentlessly, virus hunters did come across a few special types of viruses that cause a tumor in some extraordinarily susceptible animal. However, these are freak accidents of nature. Over the years, virologists learned to repeat these accidents in the laboratory's artificial conditions. But only decades later did the virus hunters exaggerate the importance of these early results, seizing upon them as precedents claiming harmless passenger viruses as causes of cancer. The first known tumor virus surfaced in 1908, when a pair of Danish veterinarians studied leukemia in chickens. Wilhelm Ellermann and Olaf Bang experimented and discovered that only something tiny enough to pass through a bacteria screening filter, a virus in causing the same leukemia in newly infected chickens, would meet Koch's postulates. The following year, a virologist named Peyton Roos, who worked at New York's Rockefeller Center, made an even more dramatic finding. When a farmer brought him a chicken with a large, well-developed solid tumor, Roos discovered that some filterable virus from the bird produced amazingly rapid tumors in other chickens within weeks or even days of infection. The Roux sarcoma virus, RSV, is a retrovirus. The hallmark of retroviruses is not to kill the cell it infects. As such, they are potential carcinogens. But neither of these experiments shook the scientific world because human cancers are not contagious. They dismissed Roux's virus as some oddity of chickens. Tumor biologists also could not find viruses in the human cancers they studied, and they therefore refused to take seriously the observations of the early cancer virus hunters. Several more animal tumor viruses were found during the 1930s. A possible leukemia retrovirus was noticed in certain strains of mice, as was another retrovirus that appeared to cause breast cancer in some mice and that also seemed to pass from mother to child through the milk. Both cancers, however, proved almost impossible to duplicate in the lab and would affect only special strains of mice weakened through generations of incestuous inbreeding, a process long known to cause medical problems in humans and animals, including spontaneous cancers. The same viruses produce no effect when injected into wild mice. Meanwhile, another researcher at the Rockefeller Institute, Richard Shope, isolated the cause of warts in rabbits, a virus that performed more consistently. A handful of virus hunters became excited when Peyton Roux caused true cancers rather than mere warts in rabbits injected with the wart virus and some substance called tumor promoter. But this virus, found in wild rabbits, would induce the dramatic tumors only when inoculated with tumor promoter. In a sense, both sides of the virus cancer controversy were right. Some viruses could genuinely cause some rare cancers, though only in specially susceptible animals under precise conditions. Yet such exceptions bore no relevance for human and animal tumors in general. Such scattered observations by virus hunters did not sway the cancer investigators. When Franklin Roosevelt signed the 1937 legislation creating the National Cancer Institute, NCI, a report issued by an advisory group of cancer biologists declared without hesitation that the very exhaustive study of mammalian cancer has disclosed a complete lack of evidence of its infectious origin and dismissed viruses as agents that may be disregarded. The report echoed the view common among cancer researchers. With no real evidence on which to stand, the field of cancer virology seemingly faced certain extinction. As a new federal institute charged with managing the fight against cancer, the NCI turned its main attention to developing radiation and chemotherapy treatments against tumors. Of the 24 grants disbursed by NCI during its first 5 years, only 2 funded virus research, both relatively small. Ironically, however, over the next 2 decades, the NCI would become the very instrument that kept cancer virology alive. Despite their lack of relevance for human cancer, a few virus hunters managed to secure positions in the new agency. The steady trickle of virus experiments did little to advance a general understanding of cancer, but it did begin attracting a few virus hunters to the field. Their one trump card lay in the Roux virus, which stood out for causing its tumor within days of infection, in contrast to chemicals, radiation, and other factors that required months to produce a few tumors in animals. One of these new cancer virologists, Ludwig Gross, began his tumor virus work at the Veterans Administration Hospital in the Bronx, New York. Having returned from the Second World War and been turned down for an NCI job, Gross accepted a position at the hospital because they allowed him lab space in the basement for part-time research. He picked up the work first done in the 1930s on a virus suspected of causing mouse leukemias, one that seemed to induce cancer only in the more sickly inbred strains, but not in healthier mice. After years of persistent study, he finally isolated a retrovirus in the early 1950s. As a leukemia virus that could cause disease only after months of chronic infection in newborns of certain mouse strains, his findings stirred little interest. But during one of his virus isolation procedures, Gross also accidentally found a virus that caused a much more pronounced tumor of salivary glands in the mice. These 2 mouse viruses soon became the foundation upon which a revival of tumor virology was built. Only a couple of years after Gross announced his findings in 1953, James Shannon took over as director of the National Institutes of Health. By this time, the NCI had become a branch of the NIH. The sudden cash flow that followed and the spending priority on polio uncorked the virus-hunting bottle. many scientists decided to redirect their careers toward cancer viruses. At the NCI, Sarah Stewart, a former NIH researcher trained in virus research, had already begun duplicating the work of Ludwig Gross in isolating his two viruses. She discovered that the second virus not only caused tumors in the salivary glands, but also induced many other cancers throughout the bodies of her newborn mice and therefore dubbed it polyoma, meaning many faces. A number of the cancer biologists continued to criticize the virus discovery, but virologists enthusiastically followed her lead. The challenge became obvious: to find a virus that causes cancer in humans. The war on polio provided an unexpected opportunity for finding new viruses. In 1959, the Salk polio vaccine was in wide distribution, and the Sabin vaccine was undergoing large-scale trials in foreign countries. Almost simultaneously, two scientists independently found a new virus in the monkey kidneys, in which the polio virus was being mass-produced for the vaccine, in other words, a contaminant. The virus was native to monkeys and caused cell death in the kidney tissues. Inspired by the polyoma discovery, both researchers injected this virus into newborn hamsters in an attempt to cause cancer, even though neither yet knew of the other's work. To the investigators' excitement, the hamsters did indeed get tumors from the virus. As the 40th virus isolated from monkey cells used to propagate polio vaccines, it was named Simian Virus 40, or SV40. The new virus was first publicly announced in 1960. Millions of children in the United States and abroad had already been immunized with polio vaccine contaminated with this potentially cancer-causing monkey virus. Another million soldiers had received vaccines for a different disease that had been similarly contaminated. Huge studies tracking vaccinated people soon confirmed no unusual cancer cases among them, but the virus hunters had achieved their victory. In the wake of the near panic over SV40, growing amounts of research dollars were earmarked for cancer virus study. In 1959, for example, NCI specifically reserved the extraordinary sum of $1 million for the field. The notion that viruses might cause cancer in humans had been firmly embedded in the thinking of the scientific community. NIH investigator Robert J. Huebner spoke for many scientists who had joined the growing polyoma research program. "Wouldn't it be interesting if more tumor viruses turned out to be similar to and spread like the common cold?" Meanwhile, the mouse leukemia virus first isolated by Gross had created a parallel field in the tumor virus hunt. Dozens of scientists rushed to find leukemia viruses in animals and humans. From 1956 to 1970, at least a dozen different viruses were isolated from mouse leukemias by researchers throughout the United States and other parts of the world, even as the NIH were dispersing new grants all over the globe. None of these viruses proved to be any more potent than the first one. Several reports of viruses infecting human leukemic cells also poured in, though none met Koch's postulates. The researchers chasing such human viruses knew how to get public attention. One lab named the virus after its discoverer, Elizabeth S. Priory, giving it the intriguing name ESP virus. While achieving only dubious results, the net effect of this research was to draw large numbers of virus hunters into studying cancer. As the war on polio wound down, its soldiers switched to the only medical field left with high expectations of success, bringing with them many harmless human viruses they had isolated as byproducts of their polio research. Ludwig Gross and other virologists openly argued that human cancer viruses would soon be found. Albert Sabin and many of his fellow polio virologists attended conferences and listened to the new clarion call. Talk of vaccines against cancer filled the air. Wendell Stanley, the first scientist to receive a Nobel Prize for viruses, entered the national spotlight as one of the leading lobbyists for a full-scale cancer virus program. At the third National Cancer Conference held in Detroit in 1956 and partly sponsored by the NCI, Stanley declared, "I believe the time has come when we should assume that viruses are responsible for most, if not all, kinds of cancer, including cancer in man, and design and execute our experiments accordingly." Literally dozens of hitherto unknown human viruses have been discovered during the past year or so, mostly as byproducts of polio research. The discovery of this great array of hitherto unknown viruses coursing through human beings made necessary a special conference devoted to these agents. This conference was held in May 1956 at the New York Academy of Sciences under the thought-provoking title of Viruses in Search of Disease. Thus, we have today many more human viruses than we know what to do with. Hence, there is now certainly no reason to shy away from giving consideration to viruses as causative agents in cancer for lack of the viruses. Actually, these recent developments lead one to suspect that there are many more undiscovered viruses present in presumably normal human beings. Scientists now had plenty of raw material, many human cancers to explain, and a growing list of evidently harmless viruses to blame them on. The new NIH money rolled in as Stanley and others beat the drums for a new virus hunt. As had happened so often in the history of microbe hunting, such battle cries ultimately generated medical disasters. But this time, the crusade was better financed and organized than ever before. Slow viruses to the rescue. No amount of enthusiasm by itself could bridge the giant chasm between viruses and cancer. The handful of cancer-causing viruses found in some animals were considered odd precisely because most viruses kill the cells they infect rather than making them grow better. And as clinical cancer specialists knew all too well, human tumors rarely contained any detectable virus particles, nor did they expect to find any, since cancer typically behaves as a non-infectious disease. Most tumors develop gradually over years or even decades rather than striking quickly and affecting large populations, as seen in flu epidemics and other contagious diseases. Against such common sense, the virus hunters somehow had to justify their anticipated cancer viruses. Carlton Gajdoszek's sudden popularity in the early 1960s derived largely from the cancer virus crowd. His hypothetical slow viruses presented part of the answer they were looking for, viruses that could supposedly act as slowly as the cancer. The cancer virologists lent their full support to promoting Gajdoszek, and he responded in kind. Already at the 1964 Scientific Conference on Unconventional Viruses hosted at the NIH, he proposed in his introductory presentation some 9 human tumors as possibly being caused by slow viruses, including 2 types of leukemia. But even this invention would not suffice. Virologists needed some way to rationalize the absence of detectable viruses in tumors and the inability of such hypothetical microbes to kill the infected cells. A full decade before Gajdoszek arrived on the scene, a French biologist named André Elwoff had already supplied this missing ingredient: the notion of a dormant virus. As with so many virus-hunting myths, the notion of dormant viruses began with a minor but genuine observation in bacteria that was later twisted into relevance for human cancer. Elwoff began his microbiology career in the 1920s with the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Over the next 25 years, he developed better methods for culturing microbes and learning about their nutritional requirements. During the mid-1930s, while his nutrition work continued, he heard about a strange phenomenon being studied at the Institute. According to a couple of his peers, certain strains of bacteria could be infected by a virus that would often become dormant. The virus literally went to sleep inside the cell, rather than killing its host and infecting new cells. Then at some later time, seemingly normal bacteria could suddenly burst open, releasing the newly reactivated virus. Since Elwoff could not come up with a rational explanation, many prominent scientists refused to believe his observations were true. But 1 year after the end of World War II, Elwoff was challenged to prove his ideas of dormant viruses at a conference in the United States. Returning to Paris with a grant from the U.S. National Cancer Institute, he set up his own research program to study this virus latency. After a series of careful experiments, he proved that the virus could indeed become latent in the infected cell for varying periods of time and would reawaken when exposed to ultraviolet radiation. Soon, even the most hardened skeptics were convinced. The phenomenon was certainly interesting, but it applied to only a few viruses. Most viruses lack the ability to become dormant and must either kill the infected cell immediately or fail altogether. Nevertheless, Elwoff's timing could not have been more perfect for the cancer virologists, and he soon made the connection. From 1953 onward, he argued forcefully that cancer resulted from the reactivation of dormant viruses, which would begin to recruit cells to form tumors. His hypothesis struck the right chord with tumor virologists. Ludwig Gross, while in the process of experimentally describing his mouse leukemia virus, echoed the emerging view. When inoculated into a susceptible host, mouse, the agent remains dormant or harmless for its host until the host reaches middle age. At that time, for obscure reasons, the hitherto latent agent becomes activated, causing rapid multiplication of cells harboring it. This results in the development of leukemia and the death of the host. Both Gross and Lwoff encourage the increasingly popular belief that all tumors might be caused by such viruses. At this point, the virus cancer view ran headfirst into another fundamental problem. In the frenzied drive to isolate tumor viruses from humans, scientists could find no virus that had been active in tumors of a given type. By Koch's first postulate, this would eliminate all such microbes as tumor-causing candidates. But the virus hunt was in full swing, and no virus researcher intended to give up the chance to find the trophy of his career. So rather than abandon cancer viruses in favor of Koch's postulates, the search was on for viruses that could cause cancer without ever multiplying in the tumor. The leukemia virus discovered by Gross did have a latent period, but it seemed to cause the cancer only after awakening to multiply aggressively in the body. The polyoma and SV40 viruses, on the other hand, caused cancer in hamsters by inserting just some of their genes into infected cells. The products of these genes were sufficient to cause cancer, but were insufficient to assemble cell-killing viruses. Either situation, a reactivated virus that does not kill a cell, or active viral genes left behind by a killer virus, could potentially have worked as an explanation for cancer, though only in immune-deficient animals. An intact immune system could cure such cancers just like any other viral disease, but unable to find such tumor viruses in humans, biologists took a huge leap over logic and Lwoff's classic precedent. According to the revised view, viruses could cause tumors long after infection, even while remaining latent. Under the spell of this new paradigm, Koch's postulates and most other formal rules of science disintegrated. Now a virus could perform miracles. It could infect a new host one day, remain latent for any arbitrary amount of time, and then cause a deadly cancer without even being present. Moreover, scientists could now pretend that any cancer was infectious simply by blaming it on any virus that found in the patient's body, without fear of being disproved. One would not even need to find the virus to prove its guilt, and if it was found, one had decades of immunity before the virus would cause cancer. This self-delusion joined hands with the hunt for human leukemia viruses, and in the 1960s claimed its first success. The story began with Dennis Burkitt, a British surgeon working at a medical school in Uganda in the late 1950s. He noticed large numbers of children with malignant lymphoma, a cancer of white blood cells. Determined to investigate further, he spent 3 years conducting surveys of doctors all over Africa, asking them detailed questions about their lymphoma patients. Drawing the points on a map, he found the cancer struck people throughout Central Africa, especially along the eastern side. Upon seeing that the risk of getting the disease depended on which climate people lived in, Burkitt proposed that the cancer was contagious, possibly transmitted by insect bites. His idea fit the leukemia virus program splendidly. News of an obscure disease in Africa, reported by a virtually unknown English medical doctor, tended at first to be ignored. Although this fate greeted his 1958 paper, one doctor back home in London, seeing his opportunity, paid attention. M. Anthony Epstein, working at London's Middlesex Hospital, contacted Burkitt in 1961 and arranged to have sample tissues flown back to England. There, Epstein began searching for a virus. By the end of 1961, word of Burkitt's strange lymphoma and its transmission by insects brought magazine and television reporters to his doorstep. The media had not yet caught up with the new belief in infectious cancer among scientists, and they broadcast this curiosity all over the world. Another source of this news was a young C. Everett Koop, later to become U.S. Surgeon General, who encouraged virologists to study the newly discovered lymphoma after his trip to Africa. As pressure mounted, Epstein struggled to make the tumor cells grow in lab conditions. Succeeding by 1963, he and his new lab associate, Yvonne Barr, spent more months looking for the virus under the electron microscope. The following year, one showed up, a previously unknown herpes-class virus. Once they could find the virus in almost every single culture of cells from Burkitt's lymphoma patients, Epstein and his co-workers officially proposed their virus to be the cause. This Epstein-Barr virus has since been shown instead to cause mononucleosis, the so-called kissing disease for which it may meet Koch's postulates. But where the virus causes mononucleosis before the body's immune system has suppressed it, Burkitt's lymphoma strikes an average of 10 years after the immune defenses have neutralized the virus. In other words, the virus would cause mononucleosis on its own, but to cause cancer, the virus needs help from something else that is available only 10 years after infection. During mononucleosis, the virus multiplies actively and infects many cells. During Burkitt's lymphoma, it sleeps soundly in its continuing dormant state. Epstein could only find the virus growing in cells from lymphoma patients that had been cultured outside the body for quite some time. This condition gave the virus a chance to reactivate after arriving in the laboratory, with no immune system to interfere. To resolve this paradox, Epstein and others insisted that the virus had a 10-year latent period for causing cancer, but not for mononucleosis. Because the virus itself can rarely be found in a lymphoma patient, researchers must test whether the blood contains antibodies against the Epstein-Barr virus, indicating the patient was infected sometime in the distant past. Investigators first became excited when they discovered that all Burkitt's lymphoma victims had the antibodies. Upon wider testing, however, they slowly realized that all Central Africans with or without the cancer also had the antibodies. In the United States, where a small number of people have also developed this lymphoma, roughly half the population has been infected by the Epstein-Barr virus. Apparently, most children catch the virus from their mothers during the first few months of life. Now, two more paradoxes raise their ugly heads. Why did the vast majority of infected people never get the cancer? And why is it less common than mononucleosis? And why is an infected African 100 times more likely to contract the lymphoma than an infected American? To answer these questions, Epstein and his colleagues resorted to yet another virus-hunting invention, the cofactor. If Africans face a higher risk of cancer, scientists explain away the problem by hypothesizing that since Africans are also more likely than Americans to be infected with malaria, perhaps malaria helps bring on the cancer. Just like that. Now the virus researchers would like everyone to believe that a cancer requires two separate infections, not just one. To explain away other discrepancies, more cofactors can be thought up. The American and European lymphoma cases have provided an even bigger blow to the Epstein-Barr virus hypothesis. 1/5 of the patients have no antibodies at all against the virus, meaning they have never been infected. Further, more than 2/3 of the cases have no traces left of the virus in their tumor tissues, not even tiny fragments. What could be causing Burkitt's lymphoma in these people? Something else, according to virologists, that remains unknown. Koch's first postulate that the suspected cause should be present in all cases of the disease no longer enters the equation. Finally, evidence gathered at the level of DNA shows that each patient's cancer originated from a single white blood cell. If virus infection caused cells to become cancerous, one should find every tumor having originated from the millions of infected cells, but each cancer comes from only a single cell. Virus hunters simply cannot explain why all the other infected cells remain normal. Many scientists have found the above paradoxes too much to swallow. Within just a few years of the announcement of the Epstein-Barr virus, many researchers were already expressing serious doubts about the virus hypothesis of Burkitt's lymphoma. Today, epidemiologists disagree amongst themselves about whether or not Burkitt's lymphoma is an infectious disease, declared a well-respected 1973 textbook. Other prominent scientists have admitted having reservations, switching instead to a chromosomal mutation hypothesis. Several scientists in the 1960s began proposing that the Epstein-Barr virus also caused a second cancer, nasopharyngeal carcinoma. This cancer, a tumor occurring at the back of the nasal passages, mostly shows up in adults in China, India, and parts of Africa, and among Eskimos in Alaska. The virus also was blamed for this cancer simply because many of these patients have antibodies against the virus. But as with Burkitt's lymphoma, many of these victims also have never been infected by the virus while it is dormant in the rest. So now Epstein-Barr has become a virus that causes at least three diseases, two of them cancers that only appear long after the virus has settled into permanent latency. Despite all doubts, most virologists today thoroughly believe in this virus-cancer hypothesis. It is taught as unquestioned doctrine in college courses and textbooks, and employs large numbers of virologists in performing endless experiments on the virus. Epstein has even worked on a vaccine against the virus in order to protect the world from cancer, though the cancer patients hardly need immunization, given that their antibodies have long ago suppressed the virus. After years of work and spending nearly $10 million on research, British scientists announced they would test a new vaccine in late 1993 or early 1994. Once they expand the trials, they will need decades to see if they can prevent cancer. Despite its failure in terms of public health benefits, the Epstein-Barr virus hypothesis helped accelerate the hunt for cancer viruses. The search specifically for leukemia viruses had grown so dominant that the NCI had set up a special acute leukemia task force in 1962. Under James Shannon's leadership, the NCI had learned to set up programs that would attract more funding from Congress, making it the largest and most powerful of institutes under the NIH umbrella. The first of these, established during the 1950s, involved a huge effort to develop chemotherapy treatments for cancer. The second, begun in 1962, was a testing program to find potentially cancer-causing chemicals in the environment. The third was built around the leukemia virus group in 1964 and became known as the Virus Cancer Program, which by 1968 took under its wing all other cancer virus research, including the work of Peter Duisberg, who had then just been appointed assistant professor of molecular biology at the University of California at Berkeley. Illustrating the complete reversal of fortunes on the part of the virus hunters, this third program became the only major NCI effort to determine the fundamental cause of cancer. The NCI budget, at some $90 million in 1960, jumped to more than twice that figure by 1970. Fueled largely by the Epstein-Barr virus discovery, the virus cancer program seized the lion's share of this new funding. Its 1971 spending level had reached $31 million, almost equal to the other two cancer programs combined. Thus, cancer virology came to dominate the NIH itself, holding the most powerful position within the entire biomedical research establishment. Some grumbling about this inequality periodically surfaced from non-virologists, but the growing budgets and accumulating prizes spoke more authoritatively in the politics of science. Even the sheer volume of research papers published by the virus hunters growing rapidly during the 1960s tended to drown out all criticism. Yet the rise of virology had only begun. President Nixon's War on Cancer. James Shannon's retirement from directing the NIH in 1968 left a decided vacuum at the top of the biomedical research pyramid. In the absence of his firm control, the growth of the NIH temporarily slowed. Although their budget had reached $1 billion the previous year, the spending increases during the subsequent 2 years ended up being smaller than before. After 15 years of soaring affluence, the leaders of American biomedical science were poorly conditioned for austerity, recalled Daniel S. Greenberg, editor and publisher of Science and Government Report. The NIH certainly faced no financial troubles whatsoever, for spending was still moving upward. Nevertheless, the research community rang with alarms and doomsday prophecies. The bloated but hungry science establishment and its lobby wanted some way to relive the glory days of James Shannon. Their decision? Maneuver the government in declaring war on cancer. After 3 years of aggressive lobbying by wealthy political strategist Mary Lasker, plus a Senate-created national panel of consultants on the conquest of cancer, public drum beating by columnist Ann Landers, self-serving testimony by medical scientists, and even a procession of cancer victims before Congress, the National Cancer Act was passed in 1971 and signed at a large press conference by Richard Nixon 2 days before Christmas. Some lobbyists had openly boasted this would bring about a cure for cancer by 1976. Others drew the analogy with the moon landing, persuading legislators that the shower of money would work similar miracles for medicine. In the final analysis, neither benefit materialized, but some $800 million extra dollars poured into the NCI over the next 5 years, bringing with it equally generous sums for the rest of the NIH. The largesse of the war on cancer has continued up to the present day. Once again, the growth of biomedical research skyrocketed, much of the money being used to train yet greater numbers of new scientists who would themselves become grant dependents. Of all research areas so funded, virus hunting grew the fastest and emerged by the 1980s as unquestionably the dominant force in the science establishment. Its research now fills more than 1,000 pages of scientific journal space every month. The virus cancer program of the NCI had positioned the cancer virologists to be first in the line for the war on cancer. Prominent spokesmen such as Wendell Stanley, Ludwig Gross, and André Elwoff had kept up the crusade for the growth of this field in the early 1970s. Along the way, they were joined by many others, including Robert J. Huebner, a veteran of the war on polio, who until 1968 had run a lab at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, another branch of the NIH. He then transferred to the NCI, where he was given one of a handful of well-funded labs. Having first studied the Coxsackie virus and other spin-offs of polio research, he switched into the cancer field by adding to the growing literature on the polyoma virus. In 1969, he published a key paper amplifying André Elwoff's hypothesis, proposing that all human cancer was caused by latent viruses that awoke to cause tumors when radiation or other insults struck the body. That same year, Nobel laureate James Watson joined the cancer virology crusade. As head of the Cold Spring Harbor Research Facility on Long Island in New York State, he brought SV40 research to the laboratory in 1969. From that point forward, he added his prestigious voice to the chorus of virus hunters. In 1974, he hosted the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium on Tumor Viruses, the first international cancer meeting held exclusively for virologists. Annual tumor virus meetings have been held there ever since, becoming the most highly respected tumor virus conference worldwide. Not all virologists held as much enthusiasm. In his 1966 Nobel acceptance speech, Peyton Bruce, the discoverer of the Ruse sarcoma virus of chickens in 1909, admitted having left the study of tumor viruses altogether for several years after his finding. He had failed to isolate any other tumor viruses and felt the field held little promise. Despite having re-entered cancer virology, Bruce could only comment by 1966 that the number of viruses realized to cause disease has become great during the last half century, but relatively few have any connection with the production of neoplasms, cancers. Regardless of Bruce's skepticism, the very fact that he had won a Nobel Prize for his chicken sarcoma virus helped boost the prestige of the virus cancer program. The cancer virus field, boosted by Nobel awards, public advocacy, highly visible scientists, and some landmark discoveries in 1970, benefited more than any other program under the war on cancer. Even the man appointed as NCI director to manage this war, Frank Rauscher, was a virologist. This favored position caused some resentment by other scientists. A 1974 report issued by an outside committee outlined the problem. First, the committee said, "The VCP, Virus Cancer Program, is too expensive. It costs about $50 million to $60 million a year and consumes slightly more than 10% of the total NCI budget. Second, the program must be opened up to the scientific community. At present, it is run by a handful of persons who have undue control over large amounts of money, which goes to only a limited number of laboratories. Furthermore, the individuals who award contracts are in a position to award them to each other, which somehow does not seem quite right." The virus hunters certainly made up a powerful and entrenched clique that increasingly dominated biomedical research. Minor bureaucratic reforms altered the operational details, but as the money continued to flow, their influence only grew. Given this built-in bias, cancer biology was quite likely to search for more viruses. Viruses to cause cervical cancer. During the 1960s and 1970s, cervical cancer became possibly the single most important virus cancer project of all time. By blaming the tumor on viruses, tumor virologists have managed to cultivate public interest through a widespread campaign of fear. Readers of the Los Angeles Times magazine opened their March 1, 1990 issue to find disturbing news. A large color photograph of a young, frightened-looking married couple drew one's eye to the ominous title, Dangerous Liaisons. Several paragraphs down, the story explained further. Patty and Victor Verpalat are infected with a strain of human papillomavirus, HPV, the virus that lurks behind one of the country's fastest-spreading sexually transmitted diseases and is rapidly becoming a prime suspect in the search for the causes of cervical cancer. As much as 15% of the population may already be carrying the virus, a fact that many health officials view with alarm. As a result, millions of Americans find themselves condemned to a sentence of life beneath the cloud of HPV, carrying in their tissues an incurable and highly infectious virus that may eventually unleash a devastating cancer. There are no drugs that can rid the body of the virus, just as there is no vaccine. Making no attempt to calm public fears, the article and its medical sources instead fan the flames. What's more, some people are spreading the virus unknowingly. It is transmitted by contact with warts, and warts often go unnoticed. Some physicians suspect that HPV may even occasionally be spread indirectly, perhaps on a tanning bed, toilet, or washcloth. According to the Times, biomedical authorities wanted far-reaching powers to respond to this supposed crisis. HPV infection is rampant among her clients, says Catherine Wiley, who oversees the family planning program at the H. Claude Hudson Comprehensive Health Center. The spread will continue, she says, until the law requires that partners of people who have HPV be tracked down and treated. Our women have sex early because they marry at 16 to 18, Wiley said recently. As long as this disease is not reportable and there's no partner follow-up and treatment, I think we're going to have an epidemic of cervical cancer. For the victims, the diagnosis could be as devastating as the threat of cancer itself. For Patty Verpalat, it was just awful not knowing what's going on with your body and if you're going to be okay or not, she said recently. There's a certain percent chance that you're going to be all right, but then maybe you're not. In the case of Annie, diagnosed by Dr. Louise Connolly of the Manhattan Beach Women's Health Center, it was horrible, just horrible, Annie remembers, referring to her fear of what Connolly might find. There you are, spread eagle, for nearly half an hour. None of it really hurts, but every time she'd stop and look at something, I'd think, oh God, oh God, oh God. And for Nan Singer, whose husband developed genital-type warts. Even after she confronted him, her husband was reluctant to see a doctor. Nan felt betrayed and disgusted. Their sexual relationship deteriorated. Existing problems in their marriage grew worse. Nan believes her husband's response to the disease contributed significantly to their subsequent divorce. The disease in question, cancer of the cervix, is a relatively common tumor that develops slowly and can eventually destroy a woman's reproductive ability or even cause death. As with most cancer, the risk of contracting it increases with age, especially after midlife. Microbe hunters first began the study of cervical cancer with their microbiological tools in the 19th century when an Italian doctor conducted surveys and found the tumor more often among married women than among nuns.